The following program is recorded content created by the Truth Network.
Wake up, everyone. It's time for the Steve Noble Show, where biblical Christianity meets the everyday issues of life in your home, at work, and even in politics. Steve is an ordinary man who believes in an extraordinary God, and on his show, there's plenty of grace and lots of truth, but no sacred cows. Call Steve now at 866-34-TRUTH. That's 866-34-TRUTH. Or check him out online at thestevenobleshow.com. And now, here's your host, Steve Noble.
Wait a minute, Steve. Did you say even in politics, like Christians should be involved in politics? I thought politics was too dirty for Christians to be involved in. Well, if that's what you think, friend, you have bad theology. It's just bad theology to think that Christians should not be involved in politics. What's up with that, Steve? Let me just put it this way. Politics, especially here in the United States of America, affects virtually all your neighbors. And when the politics of the country is adversely affecting your neighbors, whether they're in utero or out, regardless of their walk of life, when politics affects your neighbors, good, bad, and ugly, then you should care about that because you know you're supposed to love your neighbor as yourself when politics affects your neighbors, and it does. To not be involved with politics as a Christian means you don't really care what the political world is doing to your neighbor. And that's why I say it's a violation. It's a sin. It's a sin of not loving your neighbor. And so politics is just part of the deal. Here in the United States of America, and following up with our conversation yesterday with my good friend Fred Von Cannon, I'll be out at his house this evening for a fundraiser and a gathering there of conservative Republicans. And Fred is in a very hot race, North Carolina House 35, because you've heard me saying this over the last probably, about a year. 3-2-1, we need 3 in the House, 2 in the Senate. And we need to take control of the North Carolina Supreme Court in order to have a veto-proof majority. How are we going to do that via the mechanism we know as the grand old party, the Republican Party? Nobody better to talk about that than Michael Whatley, who's the chairman of the North Carolina GOP. Michael, thanks for calling in, man. How are you?
It is great to be on with you, Steve. Thanks so much for having me.
You're very welcome. I appreciate you being here. Thank you for all your efforts. This is a huge, we're like six and a half weeks out from November 8th. There's so much on the line here, whether we're talking about what I just mentioned in the North Carolina state legislature versus Governor Cooper, who doesn't give a rip about the legislative process, or we're talking about the United States of America and Congress up in D.C. and what's happening in the House and the Senate. Boy, there's so much to talk about, Michael. Where do we start in terms of understanding just what's on the line on November 8th for us as conservatives?
Excellent. Well, I think there's two things that I want to mention. The first is I really appreciate your approach in terms of faith and politics. You know, I firmly believe that we have got to get more men and women of faith into politics and into the public square. You know, I've been doing a series of pastor lunches with Mark Robinson all around the state. We've done 15 of them so far, over 3,000 pastors that we've had a conversation with about them being involved politically, running for office, and getting evangelicals registered to vote so that they can engage in the public square. This is one of you know, the projects that I feel strongest about as a chair. So your approach, I cannot agree more with. You know, and I look at this election cycle as one of our guardrails. You know, because we don't have the president up, we don't have the governor up, but we can put guardrails around the governor's mansion. We can put guardrails around the White House. You know, when we look here in North Carolina, we have the opportunity to get those supermajorities, like you said, 3 in the House, 2 in the Senate. And I think we're in great shape to make that happen. Nothing is more important than winning the Supreme Court. When you look at the travesty after travesty that this partisan court has done over the last several years since they took a majority, we have got to be able to overturn that. You know, last cycle we were 3-for-3 on the Supreme Court, including we put Paul Newby in as the Chief Justice, and you talk about a strong man of faith in that position there. You know, that if we win one seat, we'll get the majority. But I say this, if we win one, we're going to win both, and we're going to win those two seats. And at that point, with supermajorities in the court, then the governor can just go hang out in the bunker in the basement of the governor's mansion for the next 2 years and be totally irrelevant. On the federal side, we have to get the House and the Senate. I mean, if you think about everything that has happened in the last 19 months since Joe Biden was sworn in, You know, we were at 1.4% inflation. We were at $2.39 a gallon for gasoline. Groceries were not an issue in any way, shape, or form. We had a secure southern border, and we had a strong place in the world. And here we are less than 2 years later, and we have runaway inflation caused by out-of-control federal spending and out-of-control gas prices, both of which came directly out of the White House and out of Congress. You know, you see what happened in Afghanistan, what's happening in China or in Ukraine. We know what's going to happen in China and Taiwan that's coming. You know, southern border, we've got 4.5 million illegal immigrants that have come across the border. And they're not just coming, right? They're bringing drugs, child trafficking, human trafficking. You know, Venezuela, we just found out, emptied their prison and told everybody go across the border into the United States. We've had 60 people on the terror watch list that have been arrested. How many have gotten through?
That's right.
So this is about guardrails, and it really is about the future of this country because, you know, when we get these majorities in the House and the Senate, it does set us up for what's going to happen in 2024, where we got an opportunity to take that governor's mansion in Raleigh and take the White House in D.C.
Yeah, it's such a huge thing to remember because as the Democrat Party, you know, from our perspective, Michael, you know this. From our perspective, we look at the Democrats in D.C., we look at Democrats here in North Carolina, we look at Governor Cooper, and we like to say over the last few years, man, the Democrat Party's really, really radicalized. I don't think they've radicalized. I think that's normal. I think that's normal for them now. That's who they are, and they don't give a rip about the legislative process. They'll abuse the judicial process. So the only way that you can fight that fire is you have to cut them off at the knee. So the only way you do that in North Carolina, to your point, Michael, is that we have to own control of the North Carolina State Supreme Court because they're going to run everything through the courts because that's how they get around the legislative process, which means you and me, everybody. That's how they get around us. And then for Governor Cooper, in order to deal with his veto, and Fred Von Cannon mentioned this yesterday, Michael, Cooper's vetoed more things than all former governors in North Carolina have combined. The only way you can deal with that is you have to neuter him, which means you have to get a veto-proof majority. The same exact thing exists up in Washington, D.C. in order to neuter the Biden administration. I'm not going to say Biden himself because I don't think he's that much in charge. But when we come back, we're hitting the break, Michael. When we come back, I don't want anybody to get a false sense of security. I appreciate your optimism, and we need to have that, but we got a lot of work to do in the next 6 weeks. So, Michael, I'm going to put you on hold, and when we come back, we're going to ask Michael Whatley, the chairman of the North Carolina Republican Party, what do we need to do? What are our marching orders as conservatives in order to accomplish this, to win the battle? This is Steve Noble. We'll be right back. Welcome back. It's Steve Noble, the Steve Noble Show. We have a very, very, very important election coming up on November 8th, whether you're talking about here in North Carolina and trying to have a veto-proof majority. We got to pick up three seats in the North Carolina House, two in the Senate, and we need at least one to take control of the North Carolina State Supreme Court under the incredible leadership of Paul Newby, who's one of the most remarkable Christian men I've ever met. And we need to do that in order to, as Chairman Whatley said, to build a wall, basically a restraining system around the governor's mansion. We have to do the same thing in D.C. to build that same moat and keep the Biden administration out of the rest of the world. Just stay in the White House, do whatever you're going to do for the next two years, wear your mask, get your 18th booster, whatever. You stay there. Just don't come out here and make any more decisions. We got to get you out of here. But the only way to do that is you got to take control of Congress. So we've got a lot on our plate and a lot to deal with and a lot of challenges here. And I want to make sure, even though we're confident, and I appreciate you, Michael, talking about the confidence because things are really going well. My concern is always that people are going to go, oh, it's in the bag. So I'll just stay home and not vote. We have a lot of work to do between now and November 8th, don't we?
We do. You know, North Carolina, we've got 30% of registered voters are Republicans, 34% are Democrats, and 35% are unaffiliated.
Wow.
So, you know, we are by definition a purple state, and we are always going to be a battleground at every level. So, you know, when we look at this election cycle, yeah, the atmospherics are good, but we don't have waves in North Carolina. 52-48 is a landslide, you know, and we saw that even in 2020. 5.5 million votes that were cast. You know, we delivered Tom Tillis' seat, 95,000 votes. President Trump, we delivered 73,000 votes. And Paul Newby after two recounts and 92 different county protests was a 401 vote margin.
It's crazy.
So the way that we approach the election cycle, what we need people to do is we're focused on two things. Number one, you got to get out the vote. You got to get out the vote. My favorite statistic in all of politics is if you have a five-minute conversation with an undecided voter, they're 6% more likely to go vote and vote for your candidate, right?
Wow.
So we've got 7,500 volunteers lined up all across North Carolina, all 100 counties that are out there, you know, getting out the vote, and they're knocking on doors and they're making phone calls and they're initiating those five-minute conversations. It's so tremendously important. The second thing that you got to do is you got to protect the ballot. We need election integrity in North Carolina. You know, we built a team in the 2020 cycle where we had 570 attorneys in all 100 counties, and we had 3,000 volunteers in all 100 counties. Not one single vote was counted in North Carolina without us having the observers and attorneys in the room, which made a tremendous difference.
Yeah.
You know, I'll never forget President Trump calling me after the election and saying, "Michael, I love North Carolina. You know, I went to bed and I had a small lead. I woke up and I had a small lead. You guys counted the votes and I got a small win. Your numbers
yeah.
never changed."
Yeah.
You know, and that's really the way that we want to protect it. Does that mean that it was perfect? No, not of course not. But we were able to prevent really the big issues that we saw in other places like, you know, Georgia and Arizona and Michigan and Pennsylvania. So, you know, we're building out our ballot protection team right now. We've got probably 7,000 plus volunteers that have signed up and gone through our training sessions. And we're going to have, you know, election observers and election workers and election judges that are Republicans in places that we've never had them before. We're going to be at every polling location, and we're going to be there when they count the votes again. I just think that that's tremendously important. So, you know, people can go to our website. It's nc.gop. And we've got a tab there to volunteer, and you can sign up for either, you know, the Get Out the Vote team or for the ballot protection team, because we need to get more people involved. And really the single most important thing we can do is tell people to have that five-minute conversation
yeah.
with an undecided voter.
Yeah, because the issues are out there. The mainstream media doesn't want to talk about the issues. Biden doesn't want to talk about the issues. Democrats don't want to talk about the issues. That's why they go after Trump and do various things to get your eye off the ball. But the issues that mean the most of us, Michael, mean the most to most Americans. And they're pocketbook issues. They're the southern border. There's all kinds of things to go on. So you cannot rely on the mainstream media to have that conversation. We have to have those personally. And I know in order for us to get a veto-proof majority, there's some races around the state. We're safer in some areas than others, but some really challenging races. Like we have two right here in Wake County, which most people think, you think a big city, you think Charlotte, Mecklenburg, you go to Wake County and Raleigh. Most of that's blue, but we have opportunities to kind of take some of those. Like with, I mentioned my buddy Fred Von Cannon, as well as EC Sykes over in the Senate. There are some races in this state that we absolutely have to look at and have to win, and they're closer, but man, we got to get after those too.
We really do, you know, and it's going to come down to a percentage point or two in all of these districts, which means if we get 50 votes more per precinct, that will make a difference in terms of a race. You know, Aaron Perret in Wake County has
yeah.
been doing a fantastic job. You know, EC Sykes is doing a fantastic job. He's, you know, in Wake plus Granville. You know, and you kick over just a little bit to the east where Buck Newton is running again. You know, all of these are fantastic opportunities, you know, for us here. You know, and I always say, look, if you think about statewide, all across North Carolina, we get more Republican votes out of Wake County and Mecklenburg County than we do any other county, by far, with the raw number of votes that we get out of there.
Yeah.
So, you know, from a perspective of the party, you know, I've worked very hard to make sure that we have an urban plan, that we're talking to urban voters, that we have a suburban plan where we're talking to suburban and college-educated, you know, voters in those areas, as well as just the rural. You know, we cannot rely on just juicing the rural turnout.
That's
anymore.
Right.
We've got to have strategies to go into every one of these particular areas. And you're right. You know, our overall framework for the NCGOP this cycle, we call it our Family First Agenda. And it's really about economic security and educational opportunity, because everything goes back to the family. It
That's
is
right.
about those pocketbook issues, and it's about educational issues that really truly resonate to the core of every family. Doesn't matter if they're black or they're Hispanic or they're men or they're women or they're liberal or they're unaffiliated or they're conservative. Everybody cares about their economic security
right.
the educational opportunities for their kids.
What about at the Senate level with Ted Budd? Because now we're talking about the votes all over the state matter. It doesn't matter what your county looks like, because this is a statewide race for the U.S. Senate. That's a biggie as well.
It really is, you know, especially when you consider that we have a 50-50 Senate. You know, we've got an opportunity to pick up a seat in Georgia. Pennsylvania is going to be very difficult for us to hold. So we may have an opportunity, you know, to get a seat in a place like Arizona or Nevada, you know, out west, maybe Colorado. But none of this happens if we don't hold this seat here in North Carolina. You know, we will always put cautious in front of my optimism, you know, and say that we're really bullish on where Ted Budd is doing. He's running a phenomenal race. That guy hit all 100 counties during his primary. He's well on his way to hitting all 100 counties now. He's breaking fundraising records. The guy, I was with him just the other day. We did three events in three different counties together. You know, and the guy is tireless. I told him he's losing too much weight just because he never gets a chance to eat or rest. But I feel really strong that we're going to be in a position to win that Senate race if we're going to have those five-minute conversations.
That's right.
We're going to get out that vote and we're going to protect that ballot.
Yeah, don't sit around and wait for somebody else to do this work. We all have to pull our weight on this one. Are you going to be at Salt and Light this Friday, Michael?
I'm going to be there on Saturday.
Awesome. Okay.
To join the crowd and to be speaking Saturday morning.
Excellent. Well, I'll see you down there. I'm doing the show there on Friday, and I'll catch some interviews on Saturday, so hopefully we'll get to spend some time again. Thank you, my brother, for all you're doing. God bless you. Welcome back, everybody. Great to be with you back in March. I was introduced to Dr. Mark McDonald by my friend Beth Moranville, and he's doing great work out in the L.A. area, now around the country, dealing with what we've been talking about dealing with for the last 2.5 years now, believe it or not, which is the COVID issue, and the author of United States of Fear, How America Fell Victim to a Mass Delusional Psychosis. I was explaining that to you guys a little bit on the break, and also doing a podcast with Dr. Jeff Bark, Informed Dissent, one of my favorite words, dissent. And so Dr. Mark McDonald's back with us, clinical psychiatry, also a medical legal expert. And Mark, before we kind of just crack open different cans of worms and talk about these things, I said it last time, let me say it again. Just thank you. We've never met in person. I don't know that we ever will. But you being on the front lines and having engaged, starting in a school board situation, and then just telling the truth about this stuff, which comes at a high price anymore, I just thank the Lord for people like you that are willing to step out and come out of our little myopic lives and engage a greater narrative. It's such an important example and such an important thing for people to be doing. So just God bless you. Thanks for doing that.
Thanks for mentioning that. It's difficult sometimes to get through the day when you don't have a conversation, at least one conversation with someone that has basic common sense and awareness. I had a conversation with my window repairman that came over today that kind of corrected for the previous day where I had no good conversations whatsoever. And it's those moments that you have, you know, 5 or 6 minutes with another human being that you may have never met before, who just sort of gets that we're in a really profound state of decay and despair right now, and sees reality the way that you do. And some days go by where you don't have a single encounter like that. And those are tough days.
Yeah, it's very tough days. It's hard to kind of remain hopeful. For me as a man of faith, that's where I have to turn away from the realities that I'm seeing on the ground, and I have to look at something else, something that I believe is a meta-narrative, a story on top of all that. But hey, at least according to Joe Biden, the COVID pandemic is over, so which is a kind of a ridiculous statement. But as we look at that, from your own perspective, your own clinical psychiatry perspective as a medical professional and everything you've gone through, I really wanted to ask you about what kind of lessons should we really be holding on to as we go forward, coming out of this nightmare that the COVID situation has been. But what have you learned? What should we have learned? And what do we do about it moving forward? Because I want to make sure we don't easily allow this to happen to us again. That might be too big of an ask, but we got to try.
Well, I think you just summarized the intent behind all of my speaking and writing in the last 6 months. You know, after I published my first book, United States of Fear, in November of last year, I kept getting these questions from people in audiences when I would speak. So what do we do now? How do we move forward? What can I do? What can I do for my neighbor, for my husband? And I didn't have an immediate answer to some of those questions. So I began to think about it more. And what I put together was a book that I published just a few weeks ago called Freedom from Fear, a 12-step guide to personal and national recovery, which is my way of answering that question on a personal level, not to the nation, but to the individual, just like AA works on overcoming addiction, one addict at a time.
Yeah,
I'm trying to encourage Americans to overcome their fear addiction one person at a time. I believe that that is the path forward in a nutshell. It's not top down. I believed a year ago it was. I was wrong. Top down does not work because we have too much corruption at the top.
Yep.
But at the bottom, you can actually do good. If you're a mother and you have a student in a school who also lives in your home, who happens to be your child, run for school board.
That's right.
The schools are the ones that are forming the minds of our next generation. They're also the ones that are cutting off their testicles and their breasts.
That's right.
And putting them in dresses and high heels if they're boys, and jeans and a butch cut if they're a girl, and encouraging cross-sex hormones if they're over the age of 7. And it's mostly female teachers, because most teachers are women, that are doing this, along with female therapists and female doctors.
Yeah.
You can affect change on that level if you're willing to get involved. And so I believe now that it really is up to the individual and the community, not to the federal government, not to even Congress or Senate or president. Hopefully we'll get there eventually. We'll reform those institutions. But for now, we need to reform ourselves, as if you or the person you love is actually addicted to something harmful, which is fear, which paralyzes reason, paralyzes thinking, common sense, encourages compliance, enabling. All kinds of evil crop up out of chronic irrational fear. It is the source of a lot of evil in our society. So the way out, the way forward, in my opinion, is a psychological way forward first and foremost. And it starts with the individual overcoming a fear addiction.
Yeah. And so why you think of things that you get hooked on, Netflix, pornography, whatever. But when it comes to fear, you're going to go, but you look at those other things and go, okay, these are really damaging, but people get hooked on them anyway. Right. So what does that look like? The fear addiction, because I probably talked about this when we were on in March. I've talked about it for a few years. Again, from my perspective, a biblical perspective, I just watched fear consume people and run them because they're afraid of death. They're afraid of getting sick. They're afraid of the unknown. And so they'll do anything. You go down there and you get in that little box and you put this thing on your face and then you let me put this in your arm and then I can take your fear away. And people literally, just like lemmings, just followed right along. So what does a fear addiction look like, and why do we even go there?
You know, I address this in different ways in my Substack column, Dissident MD, which is also linked through my website, Dissident MD, where I put all of my writings. And I even wrote a recent article in the last week or two addressing one specific point of this, which is, as I called it, we need to ban masks. Mm. Now, why? Isn't it my body, my choice, whether you're on the right or the left? You know, on the left, it's for abortion. On the right, it's for freedom to not get shots. Everyone agrees, you know, superficially, that we should have the freedom to make decisions about our own bodies, and putting a mask on our body is a choice. I argued in that Substack column that no, actually, they should be banned. And the immediate gut reaction by conservatives, libertarians, people that aren't on the left who like to control is, well, this is freedom. I mean, as long as they're not hurting anyone, shouldn't they be allowed to put the mask on their face? I hear this from a lot of people that I respect. Hey, look, I don't wear a mask, but if you want to do it, go right ahead. I respect your choice.
Right.
Well, my opinion has changed fully in that area, because I think that the left has co-opted the language of the common sense American, which is liberty and freedom and choice. And they're using it in a perverse way, meaning a twisted way.
Yeah.
To co-opt an action that would superficially sound really good, but is actually evil and damaging and destructive. Mask wearing is not a choice. And I'll tell you why. We have laws that ban public urination, public nudity, public intoxication, graffiti, spitting. Why do we have those bans? Isn't it my body, my choice? I mean, I can lie drunk on the park with my wiener hanging out, smelling like alcohol, vomiting and crapping on myself. It's my choice, right? I can ruin my life if I want to. We don't allow that. Well, the reason why we don't allow that is it's a public space. Our social world is public. It's a shared space. We don't allow people to have their dogs crap on the public park and walk away. Pick up after your dog. Hey, my dog, my body, my choice. No, it's not your yard. It's our yard.
Right.
And when you go out in the public, you engage in a social contract of behavior. And one of those is to show your face. And if you don't show your face, all of us should. I don't say can, I say should assume that you are up to no good, that you are going to rob or rape or maim someone. And I think that's a very reasonable assumption. So if we're going to rewrite our social norms and rewrite them for the most fearful rather than the most courageous, we are going to destroy our society. We need to ban them, because when someone puts a mask on, it's no different than someone covering their face and going into a bank. They're up to no good.
Right.
You're destroying the social fabric just as if you were exposing yourself or pissing yourself or passing out or spraying graffiti on a wall.
Well, the reality of that is you start thinking about what kind of society do you want to live in? And we already know, we've seen this with the educational process, what's happened to our kids since we started masking them, which is absolutely ridiculous, complete denial of reality, and all the costs that come with that, and the hardening of society. Listen, our society before COVID was already struggling with decent civility, just basic civility. Now you put a mask over your face, you can't even begin to, nonverbal communication is dead. Increased concern about who are these people, because, hey, guess what? Criminals wear masks too, right? It's a free society, criminals wear masks. And now everybody walking into every situation has a mask on. That should make you nervous, to your point.
It should.
But then we have a shared space. And what kind of shared space do we want? And that's something that we just kind of fell into this. You talk about this in the book. Don't be a sheep, reject the collective. Even when enough of the collective, and I'm not so sure the collective was as big as the media wants to say it was, but even when the collective is pushing you, that's when you got to have a backbone. And you got to be willing to take the heat. You know this probably better than most at this point. You got to be willing to take the heat, because if you're going to lead, you better get used to standing alone, because most people don't do that.
The reason why we have allowed the left to take over and redefine our social norms to the point now where pedophilia is now being renormed as minor attracted person,
right?
A map, which I wrote about in my most recent Substack as well. I called it Language in the Left, how language has been taken over. Mm-hmm. When we normalize evil, and I think every decent person would agree on any political stripe or spectrum that sexual molestation of a child is specifically evil. Mm-hmm. If we normalize that by changing the language, just like we've changed the word safe to mean I wear a mask. That's not safe. I'm sorry. It is not safe by any stretch of the imagination, neither as being attracted to and touching children.
That's
right. You can change the language, but it doesn't change the action or behavior.
It's still evil.
So it's still evil.
Well, hold that thought. We're talking to Dr. Mark McDonald, United States of Fear, and now most recently Freedom from Fear, a 12-step guide. This is Steve Noble. We'll be right back. Welcome back. It's Steve Noble, the Steve Noble Show, The Freedom from Fear, a 12-step guide to personal and national recovery. This is written by Dr. Mark McDonald, who was on the show back in March and has been fighting the fight about the truth with respect to COVID and masking and all the other mess that goes along with it. There's a lot of dominoes that line up behind that little C word, COVID, and all kinds of stuff going on. Clinical psychiatry, medical legal expert. His website is up there. I've got all this stuff on there. But the easiest thing to do is go to dissidentmd.com, dissidentmd.com. You can get to his first book, which is United States of Fear, the brand new book, Freedom from Fear. You can get to his Substack there. I put all those links up, as well as the podcast that he does. You can just go to anywhere you get a podcast, Apple, the regular places. Informed Dissent is the name of that. He does that with Dr. Jeff Barkey. And so we're working our way through several different things today. And when you look at the book here, Mark, and I appreciate you being on today. I know how busy you are. And we're looking at things, the fear, addiction, admit you're an addict, reject the collective, meaning don't be a sheep. Live in the real world, choose reality over fantasy. That's where, and I think I'm going to talk about that, and I want to get back to narcissism. We were talking about that a little on the break. But choose reality over fantasy and live in the real world. The one thing that progressives never want to hear, and the pro-COVID, pro-mask crowd, they don't want to deal with, is facts. They don't want to deal with facts and figures. They don't want to deal with the truth. It's all narrative, worldview, ideology in order to gain control. But they never want to deal with the facts. And we can get ourselves caught up when you like suspend your allegiance to truth and you're all about emotion and fear. And I think this is a huge problem in this country.
I completely agree. I had a conversation with a man who came to repair my windows today. Manual laborer, not a college degree guy, works with his hands, got three daughters. His wife works too, lives out in a town, you know, 100 miles south of LA. This guy has a greater grip on reality than anyone that I interact with in LA with 3 to 6 letters after his name. He said, I just ran into an old friend of mine that I grew up with, a woman, hadn't seen her for a long time. And she came up to me and she started telling me the story about how she's affirming her boy's transition to be a girl. And he looked at her and he just said to me, I thought, I don't know who this person is anymore. Mm. She is no longer living in reality. And I said, you hit your nail, the nail on the thumb, nail on the thumb. That's a good.
Hit the nail on the head. You don't want to do the other one.
Yeah. Nail on the thumb. I said, you get it because you live in reality. You have to. If you don't put the screw in the window, it falls out and then the house gets wet and robbers come through and they rob the family. So you don't have the luxury of renaming the insert as female to male or male to female. If you go get those mixed up, the screw doesn't stay in the hole.
That's right.
Now, this woman, I don't know what she does for a living, but she apparently has lost reality. She's left common sense, and now she's living in this fantasy world. And he said to me, when I approached her and she said that to me, she could sense without my saying anything that I had no idea what she was talking about, and I was completely opposed to any idea that was coming out of her mouth. He said nothing. And she immediately felt that, and she began to wave him away and to leave the conversation.
Wow.
And I said to him, this is the result, this is the consequence of people who live in fantasy versus reality. They lose the ability to engage with other people, express curiosity, and have discussions that will lead them to greater wisdom and truth. Because they know on some level, there's a part of them that maybe unconscious knows that if their feeling-based fantasy is ever confronted, God forbid, punctured by reality, that the whole balloon will collapse.
Mm-hmm.
They don't want to know the truth. They can't handle the truth.
Right, that's right.
Famous line from the movie, Jack Nicholson. That is our problem today. And the left has succeeded, basically, in encouraging, in complying with, enforcing everyone in our country to join them in their fantasy by using fear, trauma, and ultimately government force to coerce people into remaining silent.
That's right.
This is a big, big problem. This inability to live in reality, to continue to live in fantasy, and to force everyone else through this renorming of social conventions into saying black is white and white is black.
Yeah, and there's, interestingly enough, is when you're talking about that and you can't handle the truth, and I've seen that movie umpteen times, and I'm always cycling through, because I have a pretty robust biblical worldview, and in the book of Romans in the New Testament, it actually says they suppress the truth and replace it with a lie. That's not passive. That's active. It's like being a four-year-old. Stick your fingers in your ears because you don't want to hear what mom has to say. You're like, la, 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 la. I don't want to hear it. I don't want to hear it. I don't want to hear it. And how does... And everybody's has done that. And then like a lot of people in church were like, oh, well, you're supposed to love your neighbor as yourself and you're supposed to submit to the governing authorities. And then that's how they kind of baptize their desire to do what they're told. But how does narcissism fold in here? I like two or three, maybe all four of my kids are pretty regularly use the word narcissist. That person's a narcissist. They're narcissism. It's all over the place. I think narcissism actually is all over the place. So help us understand, how does narcissism fit in here with the way people act? Or like that woman who is denying the reality, and he looks at him because he probably looked like Tucker Carlson. Like Tucker Carlson's always got that look on his face like, what are you talking about? And I'm sure she saw it all over him. And then she just doesn't want to go there. To your point, she refuses to deal with reality. But how does narcissism fit in here?
I think the easiest way to explain it is developmentally. Every baby is born with what's called primary narcissism, which is the necessary state of mind to have when you're born, you're defenseless, you rely on another human, probably your mother, to survive. He is born into a fantasy world where he believes that he is the center of the universe and everything revolves around him. Now, that's actually necessary for survival, because if he realized how insignificant he was, if he was one of 8 billion other human beings on the planet, he would collapse in grief. Because he knows that with his lack of power and real power, you know, babies can't even turn over.
Right. Nothing.
For 6 or 9 months. They can feed themselves. They can't keep themselves warm. They're not like other mammals. They're born completely defenseless for over a year. If he knew how defenseless he really was, how weak, how impotent he really was, he would probably just give up on life. So this is a hardwired necessary trait to think in a fantasy, it's not real,
yeah,
that you're super important. Then when you imagine that you're wet, your mommy comes and wipes your butt. When you imagine that you're hungry, she comes over and gives you her breast and milk.
Pretty good deal.
These are necessary components of primary narcissism. Mm-hmm. However, if they don't evolve into delayed gratification, recognition of your own relative insignificance among all other human beings, the need to be aware of others around you, like your siblings, the fact that your father and your mother, they love each other too, and there's something called a couple, and sometimes the couple takes precedence yes. over the child.
Yeah.
And it doesn't mean that they're ignoring you. It means that they're focusing on their own love for one another, which is what created you. If you don't understand that, at some point, if you don't get that into your thick little baby head, then you're going to grow up into the people that we see now walking mm-hmm. the earth, especially in the United States, which are adult children, adult babies that haven't gone past their primary narcissism. And they, in a fantasy, they still believe that everything around them is revolving around them, that they are the most important in the yeah. person in the room. Their feelings, their physical satisfaction, their gratification is paramount. That is the failure to develop a healthy narcissism, which is a healthy regard for oneself.
Mm-hmm.
For example, my name is... actually pronounced Dr. Jeff Barkey, not Dr. Jeff Bark. I appreciate if you could just remember that. That's a healthy respect for oneself.
Yeah, yeah.
But saying, I'm Dr. Jeff Barkey, and I'm the best doctor in all of Los Angeles, and if you criticize any opinions that I have, I'm
right.
going to fire you as my patient, that's not healthy narcissism. And we've lost the difference between healthy respect for the self, which is sort of self-preservation, and bodily respect, respect for our values, knowing that we are to some degree important because we're human and mm-hmm. we have a mind and a body.
Yeah.
Misrepresenting that as baby narcissism is what's led to people ignoring, as Jordan Peterson is fond of saying, ignoring their own house, their own bed, and going out and trying to fix everyone else's homes. And they're throwing stones all the time as they're driving in their glass cars. This is what's happening today.
Yeah. And so they all rename themselves Karen. That's where the whole Karen thing comes from, isn't it?
Yes, that's right.
What do
Karen,
you do?
Karen, Karen.
Karen, 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 Karen. Oh, there goes another Karen. Right, we're surrounded by Karens. So we got a couple minutes left, Dr. McDonald. So what do we do about that? Should we focus on our own challenges with fear, or should we look societally as well? Should we do both? Can we walk and chew gum at the same time?
I think we should focus first on ourselves. We should give ourselves a true, honest assessment. Mm. Are we addicted to fear, or... are we feeling our fear and overcoming it, acting in spite of it? If it's the latter, good for you.
Yeah.
Now go and help others. If not, if you are honestly addicted to fear, if you are unable to think rationally, if you are unable to act in service of others, you must, for your own good and that of the community, to overcome your fear addiction, admit that it's a problem, and start working on it. And if we, all of us collectively, can do that
yeah.
simultaneously, then... we can go from the bottom to the top, and we can reform from the local community up to the federal level. That, I believe, is the solution and the answer to this problem.
Yeah, absolutely. Bottom up, which the progressives have been great at forever, and kind of conservative-minded people, or just critical thinking people. That's the other thing that's died on this heap is critical thinking. Understand that from the bottom up. If people want to start really getting engaged, obviously Freedom from Fear, which is available. I put the link up on Amazon.com by Dr. Mark McDonald. The Substack, the podcast. What do you guys talk about on the podcast?
The intersection of healthcare and politics. We interviewed Sebastian Gorka, Charlie Kirk, and Joseph Lodapo, the Surgeon General of
yeah.
Florida that was hired by
yes.
Governor Ron DeSantis last year.
Wow.
And we talk about how healthcare, medicine, and politics intersect on every level. And you can see those
Man.
Three minds, Gorka, Lodapo, and
That's
Kirk,
awesome.
All approach it in different ways, but all with brilliance.
That's awesome. That's the podcast, Informed Dissent, with, of course, Dr. Mark McDonald and Dr. Jeff Barkey, which is exactly the right way to say his name. Hey, Mark, it was great having you back on the show, man. God bless you. Thank you for your efforts. We'll do it again.
Thank you.
You're welcome. We'll talk again later. Okay, everybody, this is Steve Noble on The Steve Noble Show. God willing, I'll talk to you again real soon. And like my dad always used to say, ever forward.
Another program powered by the Truth Network.